I'd like to call the meeting to order for the House Special Committee on Oil and Gas. I'm Dick Coring. I chair the committee. And with us, we have Representatives Brokberg, Nahlstrom, McGuire, who just walked in. Thank you very much. And Representative Gardner. And I've been told that Representative Samuels is on his way. He's literally in another meeting right now, so he has a valid reason for not being here. We have today just one issue, but it's a very important issue. No legislation, but it's a presentation by two gentlemen here from British Petroleum. And we're going to talk about the viscous oil issue, and that's, of course, the heavy oil on the North Slope. And that's a very significant issue because it represents phenomenal potential as far as development and extraction of oil in the future. And we're hoping to move in the direction of getting that oil developed, at least to a degree. And as technology increases, we're able to access more and more of that oil. And we'll have these gentlemen explain exactly what this is about, what the potential exists. And we're hopeful to be able to get some legislation in sometime in the near future that would encourage this. Not that we're going to pressure the industry, but at least it's a tool to put in our toolbox of things for the industry to use to hopefully further development in the state. So I'd like to introduce to the committee Mr. Don Dunham, who is the asset manager and North Slope Viscous Oil Strategy Lead. Did I say that right?
Yep.
That's quite a title.
Wow.
And then Chris West. Chris is originally hails from London, England. Had a very nice conversation with him today. He's a longtime Alaskan, I might add. Guess he qualifies for, what would it be, sourdough status. Anyway, he's the Viscous Oil Technology Team Leader. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for flying down from Anchorage. It's an honor to have you here, and we'll turn it over to you.
Well, good. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you. I hope this can be an interactive session because I think it's a complex issue, viscous oil, and it's we've tried to actually lay out some slides, some of which are in front of you, and some more detailed ones that'll be here. So all questions are great ones, so hopefully we can go through that. I'm going to do the first part here, and then Chris will take over. Get the sleep. Waking up. But the first, we're going to have three main themes. We're going to talk about the scope and scale of the opportunity of viscous oil, and then talk about the challenges that are out there, and then talk about the technological items that we actually need to conquer to get after the viscous oil. So the kind of the agenda there.
Excuse me for the interruption. I would like to recognize my good friend Beth Cartula, who's just joined us. And the meeting did start right on time at 5 o'clock, just for the record. Thanks, sir.
This slide is interesting. It talks about BP Alaska's strategy since 1977 when we got started here in the industry. But it's kind of, you know, you can overlay, obviously, all of Alaska's production. This top graph basically is BP's share of oil production over what we see is at least the life of the North Slope fields. You'll notice we see a 50-year future as a possibility. I see this as not only what's predictable, but what's unpredictable, if we can solve a lot of things that we don't know how to do. You can see the early part was all about growth in the oil production, getting up at 1988 when we were at 2.2 million barrels a day of oil production at the peak of the industry. And then as we got away from just Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk and developed other fields, it was what we'd call broadening, but we were on a decline of production to where we are today, which is at a flattening point. We call this kind of a period of transformation because we're at a point between what we'll call a bridge to gas. Gas is the red area. The base here in green is basically our light oil production, like Prudhoe, Kuparuk, Milne, North Star, and what we see, how long those fields can actually go out if the upper layers are actually on top of that. The little yellow wedge there is the viscous oil that we actually think we know how to do, and we call it water floodable. It's actually technology that exists, and this is if we're successful. The little hump later on is actually what we'll call our aspirational viscous oil, and that is more than double the viscous oil that we know how to do. There's a lot of opportunity out there. The question is how far can technology, economics, and sheer willpower actually go to solve the challenges we'll talk about. And then there's an assumption of gas, hopefully around the middle of the next decade coming on. This is a sign of our reserves. This is from a BP point of view. We see that there can be over 5 billion barrels just from BP if we can actually solve all the problems that are out there, whether it be gas, whether it be viscous oil, whether it be extending field life from Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk. But none of these are not guaranteed. The green wedge is one that is what's developed right now, but almost all the rest of it is more to play from for the viscous and the gas. Our strategy is pretty simple. It's focus, transform, and bridge to gas. Focus on managing the decline of the light oil fields. In other words, drill more wells, do more well work, be more efficient, and try and keep that decline as slow as possible and unlock this, which is what really that hump in that yellow bar is. And all of this has got to do this as time goes on and we have less production. We have to transform the cost base. This is one of the highest cost areas, being, you know, Arctic, remote, and cold. So we actually have to be as efficient as we can to be able to have this future. And all of that's in service of hopefully bridging to gas, which will come on hopefully sometime in the next decade.
Excuse the interruption. We've been joined by Representative Ralph Samuels. Thank you, sir.
This is an example of the business unit, the reserves of the business units in BP. And it's broken up in reserve categories are varying degrees of certainty. The solid green at the bottom is what's called developed proved reserves. The big message here is of all the business units in BP, if you include the uneconomic and possible reserves, Alaska is the biggest slice of all of BP, one of the largest oil companies in the world. The light oil, though, is almost all optimized and been developed. So you can see there's very little light green here on top of the developed solid green. The yellow are possibilities of things that either we think we know how to do or they're just a little not quite economic, or they actually could be extensions in the future. And the red are things that are uneconomic, or we sometimes call them barrier. I mean, gas would be an example. You can't export it right now. Some of the viscous oil is another example. Some of the hardest viscous oil is in the uneconomic at the moment.
Sir, if you don't mind, we'll take questions from the committee members as we go along, if you don't mind the interruptions periodically. With that, we've got a question from Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the developed portion on this graph up here, why does the developed part vary so much, the BP units across the horizon?
Different age of business units, examples, fields that have been on for 30 years and everything's been developed, they would have more green. The ones that are real small might be newer areas like Angola or Azerbaijan or places
So these are specific fields, not over time.
They actually tend to be countries or major regions.
Oh,
Alaska happens to be one big group, but often, like Europe, may be linked together. The North Sea would be linked together.
Thank you.
But the big message here is an awful lot of undeveloped barrels in Alaska in the red that are tough to access, and viscous and gas are the main components. This is a simple map of the North Slope. The green area are the light oil fields that have been developed, Kuparuk, Prudhoe, Milne Point, North Star, Endicott. And overlaying those, much more shallow, is this gray area. I like to remember it as kind of looks like an elephant. And that is the heavier oil. It's at a more shallow depth. It's colder because it's closer to the permafrost. And it's the other interesting thing here is we've shown the ownerships of the major fields that have the fields that have viscous oil. Milne is 100% BP and operated by BP. Orion and Polaris are part of Prudhoe Bay, which is operated by BP. And Kuparuk, BP has a major interest in. The other thing is to see the significance of ConocoPhillips here. But basically, BP and ConocoPhillips are the major players in viscous heavy oil. You can also see that most of it is in the Milne-Kuparuk area. There's the Orion and Polaris is the portion that's in Prudhoe. This is an example to try and, there are two major tranches of viscous oil in Alaska. One is West Sac Schrader Bluff. They're the same formation. They just got named different things by different people. And then there's the Ugnew, which is even more shallow. There are in place something like 20 to 23 billion barrels in the ground. Mother Nature put that there. It won't all come out. It never will. The issue is how much can you get out? In a light oil field like a Prudhoe, you might get 50 to 60% of it out because it flows better, it's better rock, it's got more temperature. But in the viscous, right now, we have found the first part of the West Sac and Schrader, we've been able to get around 20% of it out. The other 80% would be left. On these other, the rest of the West Sac Schrader and the Ugnew, I tell you right now, it's going to be zero, because it's the challenge part. It's the part we've got to keep working for technology to find. So this is it's great to see 23 billion barrels, but the issue is how much can actually get to the surface, to Pump Station 1, down to Valdez, and to market. And it will never, you'll never get all of the oil that's in there, because it just not, some of it will not come out. Viscous is not just as prolific as light. But you can see over here, this is the Kuparuk area. A vast majority of it is over in the Kuparuk area where Conoco and BP are working. I'm going to pause a while on this slide because there's a lot on here. If you remember the slide with the gray elephant, the gray elephant has now been changed to green, and basically, that is this green area here. And what we refer to this as the water floodable area. This is the area where we actually inject water to boost the pressure in the reservoir and try and get about 18 to 20% of the oil out of the ground. We've either developed that area, or these areas marked in red are areas that are we hope to develop in the future. This is kind of the stuff we think we know how to do. Not that there aren't problems that come up like sand and things we'll talk about. There's a distinct difference between this green area and then this kind of light pink area. That's getting into areas where we don't know how to water flood it. We call it non-water floodable because it's a challenged area. We don't know how to get a high recovery rate. But it's an area we're going to spend a lot of time and energy trying to access. The interesting thing is, as you go west, this is north up to the top, west to the left, the sands that hold the oil get really shallow and close to the permafrost. To the east, you're a bit deeper. In fact, this Orion Polaris area is at 5,300 feet down in the ground, about a mile. Over here, the Ugnew in this area is only at 2,000. Big temperature difference too, as you can see, 95 degrees over here, and it gradually gets colder and colder till it's 40 over here. And I guess the thing is, this water floodable stuff that we're going after this in the next 5 years, and we're trying to spend time in R&D to go after the pink area.
Mr. Dunham, that's mm-hmm. right? I misplaced my notes that had your name on there. What is the, we talked about this earlier today, just kind of a general question, but what is the overall known quantities of, in terms of barrels of the heavy oil on the North Slope, and what, based on current technologies, are we able to access right now, percentage-wise? I know the percentage is low, and you said something like 17%, or that's what you expect to get within the next several years. Can you answer those two questions, please?
So the percentage that we've already accessed?
No, what you're able to get based on current technology, and what is the total number of expected barrels that are known to exist on the North Slope, whether you can get it or not?
Yeah, if I might answer that,
sure.
Mr. Chairman. We've identified about 23 billion barrels of oil in place.
Okay.
And what you're looking at in the green there is a small proportion of that 23 billion
yes.
barrels. It's between 2 and 3 billion barrels
okay.
in the ground that we believe is water floodable. Out of that, we believe that we can recover approximately 20% by today's methods.
Okay, 20 of the 2 to 3 billion.
Right.
Okay, so maybe half a billion barrels of oil, roughly.
Yeah,
okay.
300 to 500.
Okay. Thank you. That helps. Just wanted to put this into perspective as to what we're looking at in terms of the numbers on the slope. Thank you.
Now I want to talk a little bit about the history of what we've been doing over the last 20 years in Viscous, because it's been going on since the early 80s. There's really three eras. There's the R&D era, there's the piloting era, and there's the era we're in now doing bigger projects. The R&D era went from the early 80s to about 1999. The industry as a whole spent over $500 million. Our intent was to make money out of that $500 million, but in the end, it was a painful learning curve, and we didn't get a return off of that money, except for learning. In 1999, based on that learning, we were actually able to start taking more risk and innovating well designs and start to do what we call testing at scale. Rather than doing one well here and there, we actually started doing pilots and doing a couple wells together. And built on that basis, in 2000, we were able to start doing bigger projects. Examples are the ESPAD project at Milne Point, where BP spent over $180 million. And we are now up, in 2004, we spent over $100 million in BP money, developing over 30 wells in all three areas of the viscous oil, Prudhoe, Kuparuk, and Milne. We have a very high activity in all three of those units right now. When we look at BP's business plan going forward, we as kind of technology folks want to find a way to develop about $1.2 billion of capital projects over the next decade. That's BP's share, and it's about $2.6 billion for the whole industry, because we have the partnerships where Exxon and ConocoPhillips would pay the rest. So this money would actually be spent, majority of it in Alaska, through Alaska drilling companies, Doyon and neighbors, mm-hmm. through facilities being built with Vico, and pads and things that are built by up on the North Slope. These are opportunities we're working on. Each one has to be made as a business decision as we put them forward each year. But we're real excited about that. We're also hopeful there's a lot more there, because this doesn't access all the oil.
Sure. Representative Cajula?
You mentioned a couple of Alaskan companies, but what Alaskan contractors are you using now, and who are you, you know, just to kind of give me a picture.
The contractors?
Are those people you would use in the future? Are you using them now, or like, what are the companies in Alaska you're working with?
Okay, Representative Cajula, we actually are using all of those now collectively. There's a lot more also. Doyon and neighbors do drilling depending on the field that they're at. Vico, AES, owned by Arctic Regional Corporation, works with us.
Nanacolt.
Just about everybody's done a piece of some of these projects. So we're using them all now.
And what percentage of Alaskans do you think are employed by those contractors, just to kind of get a feeling for that?
I don't know. I don't have the answer to that question. We could get that for you.
One last one. In union, what percentage are unionized of those contractors?
I also don't have that.
Could you let me know?
Be sure.
Thanks.
I'm going to recognize a friend of mine, a former state representative, Tom Bryce. Tom, I know you're hiding back there, but I was going to expose you, man. Good to have you with us. Good to have you with us. Yeah. You're welcome to join us if you'd like. Okay, thanks. Thanks for joining us. You're welcome.
If you remember the green area that we called the water floodable, now I'd like to talk about what's been developed and produced from the water floodable. Here's a graph of production that starts back in 1996. The red graph is gross production, meaning it's the total through the wellbore production.
Right.
And then a portion's taken off for royalty, and then then our other owners actually have a portion, which gets to what's BP net is in the green. And we have a line here which is kind of today. We've got our actual production in the future. Early on, the production was all Milne Point, which was 100% BP. And as time went on, we developed projects in Prudhoe Bay and in Park. So that's why the two graphs start differing. Today, we're actually close to 60,000 barrels a day of viscous oil production. That's like a field in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the fields, Prudhoe, Kuparuk, and Milne Point are at peak viscous production that they've ever been over the last few months.
Mm-hmm.
looking forward, if we can do the projects that we want to do, and they are as successful as we hope, towards the end of the decade, we could get up to 100,000 barrels a day gross of production. That would be more than 10% of the North Slope's production, and of the scale of like an Alpine, greater than a North Star.
Sir, is there any viscous oil development anywhere else in the world? Are we basically breaking new ground here in Alaska?
In some ways, we're breaking new ground, but there's a lot of heavy oil. Heavy viscous are somewhat used interchangeably, but there's a lot of heavy oil throughout the world. Our difference is we're cold, and therefore it brings new challenges. Canada has, what is it, Chris, how many trillions of barrels of heavy oil?
Canada has 2.2 trillion barrels in the ground.
My goodness.
They can see a way to getting about 300 billion barrels, or getting at 300 billion barrels, because they produce a percentage of that.
And Venezuela has more than that, maybe by magnitudes of 10 to 100.
Mm-hmm.
Russia has a huge amount. We actually believe that the world has a lot more heavy oil than it really worries about it, because we've been worrying about light oil. It's kind of the low-hanging fruit.
Yes.
But the world's running out of light oil.
Yes.
And so you start moving to the more difficult things.
And the viscous oil on the slope, much of it is contained or mixed in with sand too, right? So when you get a chance, if you would mind touching on that issue as far as what problems that presents in terms of disposal of that sand, because I know you have to extract it. You can't separate it out underground. It has to come out with the oil. Then you got to figure out a way to dispose of that. So if you get a chance to touch on those issues, including environmental concerns.
Absolutely. If you want, we're going to show some pictures of the sand
sure.
in a moment.
Sure.
I can answer it now. If you want.
Sure, please.
Okay. If I finish here and then I'll show the pictures of the sand. This right here is sand that actually came out. You can smell it. It smells like oil. It's very unconsolidated. It's not like a rock. If you think of, you may have gone sometime to the beach and you see a sandstone rock face that's hard. That's what Prudhoe Bay is. But where the heavy oil is, it's just oil mixed with almost like beach sand, like this. And we'll show more of it, the issues that it does when it comes into facilities in just
right.
a minute.
Okay.
The key thing is this success here, the breakout from the mid-90s, which Chris was involved with, was all about well design. It's about being able to do new wells that have never been done before, multilateral wells, which I'll show you more about. And in fact, at Orion in Prudhoe, they've now done what's called a quadrilateral well, which is on production. That's four pieces of well that come off of the main well bore,
mm-hmm.
and they just drilled the first pentalateral that at least BP's drilled anywhere in the world.
What does pent mean? How many?
Five.
Five, okay.
And while that's coming back to being awake. I think the other thing is the projects right now that are being developed are the SAC project, which I think you've heard quite a bit about, which Anika Phillips and BP are spending $500 million right now developing major portion, biggest viscous development on the slope ever. And then BP and its partners are considering at Prudhoe the Western Regional Development right now, the Orion Polaris. We're going through all the studies and finalizing that opportunity to make considerations for that. Here's what the well designs actually look like. Originally, wells were just what are called vertical wells. These green bars are basically different sands with shales that don't have oil in them in between, which actually trap the oil. The problem was, when you drill straight through there, you can only perforate or put holes in a very few numbers of feet. And we got very slow oil production, and it oozed into the wellbore. And ooze is a good example of what happens. So what we perfected was, we didn't jump right to this, but we've gotten to a point where we can drill four and five zones out of one wellbore and drill these are called laterals. And these laterals can be up to a mile and a half to 2 miles long. So when you add all these laterals together, you can have more than 5 miles of the reservoir actually connected to the wellbore.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner?
I have a question about the traditional kind of wells. When you have the holes at each level or places where the oil can actually seep into the pipe, does it not fall down and then prevent seepage from the lower levels?
I guess it could. That would be to pack off. But what we do is we put pumps in the wells to actually lower the pressure and lift the oil to the surface. And that's part of the expense of actually extra, we call it jewelry, we have to put into the well.
Jewelry?
Well, it's the more complicated the well gets, the more it's jewelry pumps, ESP, electric submersible pumps, and jet pumps that you put in the ground. But almost all these wells have to be lifted with some pumping mechanism.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. You'll be an expert soon.
I'm going to suggest something before I forget. I was going to make this announcement at the end of the meeting, but we as an oil and gas office are looking at potential trips for the oil and gas committee. We wanted to facilitate, arrange for the committee, for those that are interested, to go on different trips. And I would recommend that perhaps we go to the North Slope. I've been there twice, but I'd like to go again. And it's a great learning experience, and it's fascinating to see the facilities up there. And perhaps we can go up there as a group and learn more about this and other issues. So I wanted to mention that, maybe when the session's over with, as time permits. And then there are several other potential trips we're looking at, too. And we will apprise the committee as to what we're suggesting.
That's great.
Well, that's kind of what the resource and the scale is, Mr. Chairman. Now I'd like to move on to kind of the challenges. And this is where the sand issue will come up. As I've said before, a key thing here is low reservoir temperature, around 80 degrees in the area that we've been exploiting so far. The deeper Prudhoe Bay, Endicott, North Star oil is at 200 degrees. And one of the things I'd like you to think about is, I used this analogy before, but is like maple syrup. Think about maple syrup in the freezer, in the refrigerator, in the microwave. If it's in the freezer, it won't move at all. If it's in the refrigerator, it moves slowly. If it's on the table, it'll move a little bit better. But boy, it sure does pour nicely if you put it in the microwave and give it heat. You can imagine the different, that's the same syrup, but it's just, it doesn't flow as well depending on the temperature. That's the exact same thing about this oil. So cooler oil means higher viscosity. And really the differentiating thing about Alaska's oil is viscosity. You may hear the term API gravity or 18 degree gravity. That is a measure of weight. The real issue about how hard and expensive and the challenge of this oil is viscosity, and most of it's caused by the temperature. It also makes it very difficult to separate the oil and the water and the sand that comes out of the wells. These wells may produce all water or all oil the first couple days, and then water starts coming in more and more and more with sand. But you can imagine, like salad dressing, it separates nicely if it's sitting on the shelf and is warm. You put it in the refrigerator and shake it, it stays mixed up. We can't send this mixture down taps. We've got to get it separated to clean oil before it can go to the refineries. So it's more difficult. It also brings with it a lot of sand, just like what's passed around. You could try and shut off the sand, but then you shut off the oil, the way the oil can ooze into the wellbore. So we have to find ways to deal with the sand. And the sand actually is coming into facilities built for light oil that didn't have this problem. So as we develop new projects, we have to spend money upgrading our facilities. Many of you may have heard in August, Prudhoe Bay's production took a while to come back up. It had a shutdown to actually get rid of some sand in one of the facilities. And I'm going to show you some pictures of that in a moment. But the main thing is that all of these challenges mean it's more expensive to develop. Those pretty multilateral wells are very expensive, $8 to $9 million a piece. And then all of the sand and the separation means the operating cost or lifting costs are higher. Before the pictures, I just wanted to, this is looking at a side view of a reservoir. And west is to the left, and east is to the right. Basically, what you're looking at is the different sands, the West Sac Schrader and the Ugnu above it, as you go from Kaparik River, which is to the west, to Milne Point, over to Orion in Prudhoe Bay and then Polaris. And it just reiterates the issue of depth, where you're at 5,000, 5,500 feet for some sands in Polaris. Orion gets up to 3,500 feet. Milne gets up to about 3,500 feet. And then West Sac is above 3,000. In fact, it goes farther west, where it actually gets very close to the permafrost at 1,800. Permafrost is 32 degrees, therefore the oil gets that cold. So it's in your refrigerator. This is just another picture of showing the difference between the different locations. So we've been actually trying to find a way to deliver this oil here. And as we move farther to the west, it gets progressively colder and progressively more difficult. Here's a picture of pouring the oil. Now, this means API gravity, which is what I said we really don't want to think about, but you can see two different gravities of oil. One pours out kind of nicely in the bottom of the beaker. The other is like molasses going, and that's actually at room temperature. Imagine if it's in the refrigerator. The key thing is, the issue about viscous is its viscosity, not the API gravity. Mm-hmm. And the measure of that is this little CP, it's called centipoise. And that's just a simple measure. How long does it take to go through a funnel? And water goes through a funnel, and that's a measure of one. If it takes twice as long as water, it's two. Well, some of our oil up in the North Slope, I don't know how high we go, but we know we go up probably to 10,000 centipoise. Now, right now, we're working in the 10 to 50 centipoise range is what we're working on. As we go farther west, it's thicker and thicker. Now, I'm going to show you just one. Go back here. I don't know if you want to introduce this, Chris. Go back here so we can show this. I'm trying to use a little bit more technology here.
This is just a little movie of some oil samples, just to show you the difference of how fast the light oil moves compared to the heavy oil on the left. See, she's tipping it up there, and the light oil is mobile. The heavy oil is almost immobile.
Do you extract the oil out when it's extra heavy? You have to heat it underground, or is it sucked out through pumping mechanisms, or how does that work?
Right now we can, the heavy oil that you see there on the bottom is can be pumped out still.
Okay.
When we get to the very viscous oil, this is the stuff that's still aspirational, where we're going to have to add some kind of energy to the reservoir, heat or gas or something to dilute the oil.
Okay.
Get it to move.
Now come the pictures of what a facility can see with the sand that comes with the oil. This is GC2, which is at Prudhoe. It's on the western side of Prudhoe. It's where the heavy oil comes into Prudhoe, and it's just a simple schematic of the equipment that's up there. I'm going to show you just two pictures of one and two. This is an oil dehydrator, which is, as the oil comes in, it goes through what's called a slug catcher, and it basically goes through various processes to get more and more of the non-oil out. But what happens is, somewhere in here, the sand has to go. And I want to show you what, in August, they found when we had a shutdown at GC2. This is actually the slug catcher. Now, what you're looking at is, this is a vessel 5 feet tall, okay? The bigger it is, the more volume and the more time the fluid can separate out. You're only seeing the top 1 foot here, so the bottom 4 feet is full of, for those that know what Turnagain mud is, that's what it was. And this facility was built for light oil, and it never had this problem. But as we bring heavy oil in, we have to add sand jets and a lot of other different types of equipment to be able to get the sand out of there. This oil, the only way to get it out, and why our shutdown took so long, was in a proper safe way, send people in there with respirators to shovel out the Turnagain mud. And it took a lot longer than we expected because we didn't expect to find this much in there. And this is another look. You can go down these through ladders, so they had one rung they could get to, and that kind of looks like Turnagain mud there. So that's why our shutdown in August took longer to come back up, but when we found this, you're in there, you're shut down, you've got to fix it properly. Yeah. So it's a kind of an example of the costs that are involved and the time that, you know, you get a shutdown to clean this up. Now this mud, Mr. Chairman, you asked where it goes. What we do is we then take this out and we take it to an approved well called a grind and inject well and put it down into a specific zone back into reservoir where you can put sand and things like that. And that costs quite a lot of money. Every cubic yard, which is 3 by 3 by 3, is $150 to get rid of. And I know at Kaparik on some days we fill the equivalent of this room every day with sand. So very costly. And I'll turn it over to Chris to talk about unlocking the value.
Okay, thank you, Don. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, well, Don has explained how we've grown the viscous wedge since we started producing viscous oil in the mid-90s to today, and how we've progressed the well technology from conventional to multilateral wells. Now, I'm going to talk more about the collaboration that's gone on. I'm fortunate enough to work in an environment where we have a lot of sharing of knowledge between the operators. The operators, ConocoPhillips and BP, and Exxon, who are non-operator, have probably shown an unprecedented amount of collaboration of technology over the last years. We have three separate teams working the three fields, and each team, we've created an environment where each team can learn from the other team's advances, and that's really spurred technology growth to a point where if we hadn't have had that sharing, we would be years behind where we are now. I think it's safe to say that we're well ahead of where we would be had we not had this extent of collaboration, which in both of our experiences is pretty well unprecedented in the industry. So it's a very kind of mature environment of collaborative learning. We're also experimenting with different types of artificial lift and how to separate the oil on the surface. And we're also looking at enhanced oil recovery, which you may have seen the acronym EOR. We're looking at ways to use the CO2 that will be available in vast quantities once we start selling the gas down the pipeline. We would like to sequester that in the ground and also use it for enhanced oil recovery. And we're looking at ways to mix with the oil to dilute it and bring it to surface. So next slide, please. This is just a schematic of the types of wells that we're drilling. We're now able to drill 1.5 to 2 miles, a distance equivalent to the Empire State Building out to the Statue of Liberty, and we're able to target these wells within a foot of the target. So we're able to drill a well from the top of the Statue of top of the Empire State Building, and from that point target the well to within one of the windows of the crown. So that's the kind of accuracy that we're able to get to.
Key would be to make sure you know where the oil is, and then you can target it at that exact point, right? Once you get that down, boy, you're in business.
Remember, we've got to stay within zones that are as little as 10 feet thick over a mile section. Some of these zones are less than 10 feet thick. Next one. If you're more familiar with Anchorage, it's like drilling from downtown ConocoPhillips out to Muldoon. It's that kind of distance. Next. This is... Okay. Go back to that last one. This is just an example of some of the things that they're doing elsewhere in the world. These are the kind of wells that they're drilling now in Venezuela. You saw that we had put up to 25,000 feet of slotted liner in a well. These are wells, very exotic wells that they've drilled in Venezuela. They're called fishbone wells, where they've put up to 60,000 feet of open hole in a well and improved the rates through that.
If you look at the top, you can tell there's really only two surface locations coming down. Mm-hmm. And then they had many wells mm-hmm. coming, and they're actually targeting very precise pockets of oil. And they can drill these kind of wells for about $1 million versus the $10 million for less exotic that we drilled here.
How long has this technology been around?
Not very long,
a couple of years. We're looking at applying this technology in Alaska now. It's a question of getting the cost environment
yes.
to the right place.
Interesting.
So that's kind of part of the dream of both linking drilling and enhanced oil recovery, getting the cost base to where you can do these economically, and being willing to actually try some things that might fail, because we're going to have to do some experimenting, kind of a lot more R&D. And BP's quite excited about that opportunity. But it's a very long wavelength game. It's not like wells that pay out in a year and 5 years. We've got to be able to look very far in the future. But if we can unlock this, you start talking about a 50-year future for the industry.
Mm-hmm.
In conclusion, and be happy to take lots of questions afterwards, the thing I'd really like to leave with you is there's a huge amount of this viscous oil in Alaska. In place is uh-huh. the term. It's there. Mother Nature put it there. The recovery factors, what you can get out of the ground, are much lower for viscous than light, and probably always will be. But the goal is to broaden the area where we can get any of it and find a way to increase the areas we've already developed higher than 20%. This is a big resource to BP. We're in all of the viscous oil. We own part of all of it and are excited about it for us and for the state of Alaska. If you think about the challenge, three words are great to remember. It's thick, it's cold, and it's sandy. And that's the challenge we've got. If we get rid of the sand, we don't have the thick, and it's just cold. But it's thick, cold, and sandy. For unlocking the value, we need some technology advances. And technology, I think our society's kind of assumed that technology's off the shelf nowadays. Technology. I'll just go buy it. The technology we're talking about is things that aren't done anywhere else in the world. The first thing we try and do, because we're a big company around the world, is make sure we innovate, which to me is, what is Azerbaijan doing? What is Venezuela doing? And how can we apply all of that here? That's innovation. But to get the real value here, we're going to have to go farther than that and go where nobody has gone before and do things that we don't know how to do. That's going to cost a lot of money and R&D, and it's got to be, we can do the things that make most sense and have a chance of success. It's going to take patience, this especially for my management, patience. We've got to take time, and some of the things we do will fail. And it needs worldwide know-how, both within companies that have lots of operations, collaboration with other operators and academia and lots of different things. But we need to get the best of the whole world working this problem. Some of the knowledge sharing we've talked about, BP Alaska and ConocoPhillips are collaborating like no one I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Even sometimes companies don't collaborate inside mm-hmm. this well. We have, Chris has just been named our viscous oil technology team leader, and we're forming a viscous oil technology team to think not about today's drill bit, but for 5 years down the road. That hump, that opportunity, Chris's job is to try and help us figure out what are the experiments to make some of that or all of it a reality, and that's going to be based here in Alaska. And we also are working very closely with all our worldwide heavy oil experts, as is ConocoPhillips and other operators, but trying to focus it on the challenges we have here, which are more immense than anywhere else in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman. That's our presentation.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for that very good presentation, and I appreciate the fact that you put it all in layman's terms. You made it very interesting and very easy to understand as far as staying away from the technical jargon and just keeping it simple. So I do appreciate that. And I hope the committee is finding that these overviews that we're having are helpful. The intent is to parlay these into legislation so that by the time we have bills before us, we'll have a better understanding and hopefully produce some good legislation out of this committee. Are there any questions from the committee that you care to answer or have answered in addition to what we've already brought forth? If not, I'd like to further my monopoly on questions here and ask a few more. Before I do that, I saw a hand go up, Representative Roper.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, is there, I'm somewhat familiar with the API gravity measurement, but you're talking about focusing on viscosity, not on the API. Is there a method or is there a recognized standard of viscosity that you can use that's, you number it or grade it in that way that's got a relationship to the API, so you understand it?
Representative Rugsberg, through the chair, I can answer that with, it's actually the measurement of viscosity is in centifoise. That's the general that's the generally accepted way of measuring the viscosity of the fluid. Water has a viscosity of 1 centifoise. Olive oil is probably 100 centifoise, around about 100 centifoise. Molasses is about 1,000 centifoise. So, we prefer to work in centifoise because it represents the degree of difficulty of flow. API is a rather, it's misleading because certain API oil, different temperatures can have different viscosities.
Example 19 gravity oil at 10,000 feet might be very hot and have a low viscosity. That same oil, if you brought it up close to the permafrost, might not move. So really, gravity is an indicative, it's measured at 60 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's an issue of weight, but it's not on flow, and that's why viscosity is the key thing here.
Oh, but the gravity would have an influence on the value of the oil, would it not? The quality of the oil. So that's a measurement of quality as well as to a degree its viscosity also.
Exactly correct.
But centipoids would be the proper measurement to meet your. No jokes. It's, how many legs does a centipoid have? Mm-hmm. No, I'm not going to go there. No. That's not to wake me up. Mr. Chairman, if I might follow up on that.
Please do.
You mentioned using the CO2 for the UR. Is that going to require a substantial refitting and additional capital investment when you do that because of the, and how do you handle CO2? Isn't it somewhat dangerous to be handling it in working activities?
The industry is fairly familiar with high CO2 content gas, but it does require refitting of a lot of the surface and downhole facilities. When CO2 is mixed with water, it produces sulfuric acid, and that tends to eat away at the steel in the ground and on the surface. So we have to employ stainless steel, plated steel, and that will require substantial investment. But BP's committed to sequestering that CO2, and if we can use it for enhanced oil recovery as well, that's a win-win.
Sure. I think you would, if you were flooding it, you would recycle it then in a particular field. Is that how that would work? But you have to separate it out whenever you do that.
A certain amount of it will come back and have to be cycled around.
Just like the gas today.
One of the issues I brought up, Dick Coring here, was the issue of the sands that are produced. And I don't, unless I missed it, I didn't hear any elaboration on that as far as what becomes of the sand? How is it disposed? What environmental problems does that pose?
It's not an environmental problem. We have a place to dispose of it. We literally currently take it out of the vessels, and it goes onto trucks, which then drive to a Prudhoe Bay grind and inject facility, where it's actually ground up further and pumped down with water into a reservoir that's permitted to actually accept these. I will give you an example of something that happened right before Christmas that shows the impact of this. We had what's called phase three conditions on the north slope, which means no trucks can move and people have to stay inside for safety. Can't see, it's 40 below. And the sand pit that holds the sand gets full. Every day you're producing a room this big. So we actually had to shut in production because we had nowhere to put the sand and we couldn't take the dump trucks to Prudhoe Bay. So we're looking for ways to solve that, but it's just an example that viscous oil has challenges that light oil just does not have. When we solve one, another one appears.
Okay, thank you. The only other question that I have before you wrap it up, and of course I'll entertain any more, but that is the issue of the current facilities that are in place. Could they be used to drill for this oil? Do you have to build whole new facilities? Or can you just simply take the existing and modify them? How is that going to work?
Mr. Chairman, it depends where the oil is. An example is some of the projects being drilled are being drilled from existing gravel pads, mm-hmm. because we can now drill with extended reach drilling quite a ways. But if actually the oil is in a place where there's no gravel pad, we'll have to build a new gravel pad. And then once that gets the oil to the surface, and then we need to actually put heat into it. So we build heaters that actually heat the oil up so it flows to the facilities. Now our current facilities handle both light and heavy oil. As heavy oil becomes a higher percent of the oil up there, more issues of dealing with the mixture will occur. In fact, if we can really unlock this, you could see a day where a facility is built specifically to handle the heavy oil, and you only had heavy oil coming into it, so you had certain metals and certain sand handling and things like that.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In light oil, how much sand is there? Virtually zero.
Representative Samuels, through the chair. Most of the light oil comes from more consolidated formations that are deeper, and they don't bring any sand up. Very little.
Thank you very much. Any other questions from the committee before we wrap this up? Representative Rookberg.
Mr. Chairman, if you indulge me, thank you. The governor was giving a State of the State speech. He mentioned something what he called medium heavy oil. So I'm kind of curious how you would characterize the both the Orion and Polaris fuels in terms of either their centipoidal or their API gravity weight, and how those fuels might differ, say, from Schrader Bluff or some of the other, and how much sand and any distinctions in those particular fuels versus some of the other tools that you're working with.
Well, Representative Roper, through the chair, the pictures we just showed you of the vessels were actually of the kind of oil that Orion and Polaris are. The sand that filled the vessels was Orion oil. So actually that's an example of the sand problem. So we definitely have the same sand problem. Because of the deeper depth, it is a little warmer. It's about 90, 95 degrees. So the viscosity is not as high or thick as, say, West Sac over at Kupark, but it is still heavy oil because it's got all the issues of difficult to pump, difficult to, comes with sand, comes with a lower value for the crude, comes with a lot of the same problems. It just gets progressively harder as you go west, and it gets more viscous.
Yes, sir.
Just to follow up on that. Yes. So your testimony is that the Orion field has the sand lift problems, and you have to deal with this, as opposed to the lighter crude out of the PBU, balance of the PBU field. Is that correct?
Correct.
And I take it Polaris would be the same. Do you also have the sand component there?
It's a separate accumulation, but yes, we have the same sand problems there. because these are much shallower reservoirs than main Prudhoe Bay. And it's back to the sand that went around the room. It's an unconsolidated sand. It's not a hard rock that we're producing from. So that sand comes in Polaris and in Orion and Wessac. It all comes with the oil and water.
So would it be fair to say that the capital costs of those particular fields are similar in nature to other heavy viscous fields in terms of the drilling techniques and costs that you have to put in there, the processing and the separation and those types of problems that are intended on, or you typically find in viscous oil? Is that, would that be correct?
Yes, Representative. It's that Orion Polaris is part of this collaboration that's going on between ConocoPhillips, BP, and Exxon in the Heavy Oil Forum. We're all learning from each other. That the developments are being, learning from what's going on at Wessac and Milne, because they are the similar types of reservoirs, similar designs of drilling for the wells, the multilaterals, and having to deal with the same facilities. It's even worse because Prudhoe Bay's facilities are older. So they were built in the era of the mid-70s and don't have quite some of the facilities that Milne and the Kuparuk fields have. So you not only have all the heavy oil challenges, but you have facilities that were designed even in an era before. So there's more facilities upgrades required.
Just without getting to the exact numbers, but could you characterize the production like per well basis from Polaris, Orion, and Schrader Bluff, or in Wessac, the different, because of the nature of the particular fields are going to be different, but is their production level similar?
Representative Roseberg, through the chair, the production rates in all the fields are similar that we've experienced. We've actually seen some of the highest rates at Wessac, some of the highest initial rates at Wessac and Orion fields, because they're able to drill longer wells. It's less faulting than we see at Milne Point. But once you get over the initial decline that you see in the first year, the stabilized rates from all the fields are very similar. The wells seem to stabilize around 1,000 barrels a day.
In fact, we've actually designed kind of a well predictive model for all the fields that we use. It's a similar model to predict what the production per well will be. So Orion, Polaris, Schrader, and Wessac all use the same predictive model for the production.
So I assume most of your well bores that you're producing from are multilaterals of some type now.
Yeah.
Because you've gone and retrofitted or some of the older, remember like the Schrader Bluff, early Milne Point ones, or the old-fashioned way. And they used, you experimented earlier on with steam and some other heating techniques. Are you still using any of those types of EORs at all? Or?
I don't think we've tried steam yet. What we tended to do is to go in and drill new multilateral wells and convert the old wells to water injection.
Sure.
I was curious about, you mentioned you had to truck the sand. You don't have any permitted reinjection wells near the fields where you can minimize the costs of the transportation of the sands? Or is that a problem with the state DNR, or is it the geology that you're working with primarily?
Representative Roberg, through the chair, good question. Something we're considering right now. Prudhoe Bay grind and inject facility is for the disposal of a number of things in a permitted way and is set up in a way to handle what we used to produce. But now that Milne and Kuparuk are producing more viscous and more sand, we are exploring the need for possible other smaller grind and inject facilities west of the Kuparuk River, because there's an added problem. The bridges across the river are not accessible all times of the year also. so we don't want production to be stopped because we can't get the trucks over there. We are definitely looking at all kinds of ways to be more efficient from a cost point of view and a handling point of view. It's not good to have people shoveling things, and it's not good for trucks going all over the place. We can do a more efficient way. We probably will be doing some better projects in the next year to year and a half to fix this issue.
Thank you. Any more questions before we wrap the meeting up? Well, again, thank you very much for your presentation. I appreciate it. We look forward to working with you because there will likely be some legislation that we're working on that you'll see in the near future. So I want to thank the committee members for your not only your attendance here, but for your patience and stick-to-itiveness as far as coming to our late meetings. Because I know a lot of us start very early, particularly Representative Roekberg. So I thank you for that extra effort that you do make. What I'd like to do is just announce three quick things, though. A trip list. I'm going to produce a list that we're going to present as far as prospective trips that we as a committee can take. There's a lot of good possibilities out there. There's a tanker trip from Valdez down to Washington that I've been invited on to include members of this committee. We can, of course, go up on the North Slope, explore the viscous oil situation and other things. Oil platforms at Cook Inlet, Valdez Terminal tours, we can do that as well. So we would like to make that information available and encourage our participation in those things. I'm going to produce a list of legislation that's in the committee. I have not to date because there's been very little legislation that's been filed, read across in the record to our committee. But that is starting to change now. We're working on bills, and one was read across just today, I believe it was, or yesterday. House Bill, which House Bill was that? Was that 142? And Cerise is passing a copy of that one out. And then lastly, the Energy Council. For those of you that are not aware, there's that available to us. You have to put in to the speaker to get his authorization, but if anybody here is interested in attending that, which is on the 10th to the 13th, act quickly because we're approaching that time. Now, there are several of us here that are going to that, and what I'd like to do is to present to the committee what was discussed and what information was brought forth at that council once we return in mid-March. And it will not be until we get back that we will have another Oil and Gas Committee meeting, which will be either on the 15th or 17th. So thank you again for everybody's participation, and I'd like to close the meeting at 6:03. Meeting is adjourned.